Dr. Chris White joins me this week to discuss yeast viability, harvesting, and pitching yeast. This is Beersmith Podcast number 280.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 280, and it's early May 2023. Dr. Chris White joins me this week to discuss yeast viability, harvesting, and pitching. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. Beersmith is the world's most popular brewing software to support your beer brewing with advanced features used by craft breweries worldwide. Available in both desktop and web-based format, you can build recipes from your computer, tablet, or phone. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com or give Beersmith Web a try by setting up an account at beersmithrecipes.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Dr. Chris White. Chris is president of White Labs, Inc., a top provider of brewing yeast worldwide, as well as 2015 winner of the AHA Governing Committee Award for a Lifetime of Achievement in Brewing. He's also the author of the book Yeast, which is the ultimate reference for brewing yeast. Chris, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing today?
Thanks, Brad. It's great to be back. Doing well. I'm speaking to you from San Diego, California. And it's nice over here, and happy to talk to your audience again.
What are the before we get into the details for today, what are some of the things happening at White Labs?
Oh, it's always go, go, go. You know, making all these different yeast cultures and bacterial cultures and things for home brewers and brewers around the world. It keeps you on your toes. We produce almost 80 different yeast and bacteria strains here and in Asheville and also in Copenhagen, Denmark. And we got some great teams working on it. So making a lot of different yeasts, finalized, you know, releasing all our yeast in our new Pure Pitch Next Generation package for home brewers. We released our first strain in dry yeast, California ale yeast, for home brewers and pro sizes. And we continue to do things with our commercial brewery, White Labs Brewing Company, to keep using these different strains and Clarity Firm and things like that to experiment and taste different beers and different techniques. So we're just commissioning a new brewery in Asheville. We've been going 5 years there with a smaller brewery since we opened it, but now it's going to have a nice big new four vessel system.
Nice. That's awesome. How's you were mentioned, I think before the show, that you had done some work maybe with low alcohol yeast, I think.
Yeah, you know, that's every year, every time we talk, right? Not even every year, there's some new styles, new things people are interested in. Right now, in craft beer, non-alcohol is surpassing a lot of people's expectations on how well it's selling. And so therefore, brewers are calling us asking what types of yeast to use. And so we have three different non-Saccharomyces yeast that we make for them. But, you know, there's also non-yeast ways of doing it, of removing alcohol, and new techniques. So this new generation of non-alcoholic beer is lower calorie, lower carb, and very little alcohol. And young people are drinking them. Seems to be like non-alcohol beer or spirits are really doing well right now with consumers post-COVID. So it's just been another interesting way to explore. So I've been trying as many of these non-alcoholic beers. I used to be kind of like, I don't like them, but I don't want to keep my head in the sand. I've been trying a lot of them and, you know, getting an appreciation for them.
Yeah, I had had a guest on, I think, from one of your competitors a while back, but he had sent me a couple non-alcoholic beers made with the low-alcoholic yeast. and they were surprisingly good. I, you know, they really didn't taste like, you know, the old O'Doul's or some of the other stuff I'd had before, you know.
Yeah, it's become something that you can have that's enjoyable. It's not just if you have an alcohol problem or something and there's these poor tasting things out there, or, you know, you just don't want the beer at all. You know, I mean, there's lots of reasons in the past, but they weren't very good. Now you can enjoy these non-alcoholic beers. And especially, I think, when I ask people what they think, I like to ask the younger crowd, like the 21 to 25 year olds, is always what the brewing industry is coveting, you know, for sales and things. So I did the same thing when hazy beers came out. Like, I couldn't understand them, so I asked younger people, what do you like about them? And then, you know, they're describing the mouthfeel and the positives. And I did the same thing with non-alcoholic beer. And I think what's interesting is the descriptions I get back are not beer descriptions. And maybe that was my fault, always in non-alcoholic beers looking for it to taste like beer. But yeah, the sensory things I get back from people are lemon or tea or, you know, these other descriptors we don't typically use in beer sensory evaluation. But maybe with the younger crowd too, not drinking as much beer in their life, they're just turning 21 or something, there's more openness about some of these different flavors.
Well, today you wanted to cover yeast viability, harvesting, and pitching, which are all important topics. Let's start with viability. What do we mean when we talk about viable yeast?
Viable yeast are yeasts that are alive. So you can have dead yeast, and you can have yeast that are alive. And there's been always people wanting to, you know, find more precise ways of really understanding the yeast physiology from a health perspective. Mm-hmm. But viability is fairly easy to measure with methylene blue or methylene violet. These cells that stain darker are dead for the most part. And so it's filled with some air, but it's also, you know, fairly easy to do. And so it's still the mainstay laboratory test for brewer's yeast. And, you know, people used to say, well, it just tells you if it's alive or dead. Yeah, methylene violet does a little bit better job of that. But it also, if you have a lot of dead cells, there's probably a lot of other cells that aren't very healthy. So it does give you a sense of the yeast health as well.
Interesting. And so when we talk about viability, I mean, how long does an average yeast cell last? You know, I know, for example, liquid yeast becomes less viable over time, right?
Right. So yeast are alive, and a lot goes into how you make them and how you store them, you know, to determine how long they're going to live. Not everything can survive the same. But we're also in the brewing industry. We're in a kind of unique place where we're making beer on barley malt, malted barley, that has some nutritional value and things too. Very different than fermenting water or wine or other things, right? So, and that for that reason, brewers have always reused their yeast cultures. That's how it's been done. That's why we have the yeast strains we have, from brewers reusing and selecting different yeasts at different breweries and different regions to adapt to certain beer styles. So that's why we have what we have. And but typically, like, even when I entered the business 28 years ago officially for White Labs, but over that, you know, over 30 years in homebrewing and things, it was always thought that yeast are just alive for a few days. You know, you got to collect it from the fermenter and reuse it right away. And there's some value, there's some truth to that. I mean, they do perform, when they come at the end of a beer fermentation, they're not very healthy. There's alcohol, there's stress, there's low oxygen given to the yeast. If we were in the biotechnology field or, you know, different kinds of baker's yeast production or all dried yeast production, really, where they get a lot more oxygen, they can grow more cells and they're more healthy. But in brewing, we don't give them a lot of oxygen, just that little bit in the beginning. So they don't make as many new cells, and they typically have a viability, if you collect it, a good slurry from your beer, about 50% dead in 30 days.
Wow, that's pretty low. And obviously, when you package it, it's quite a bit longer, right?
Yeah, because we're not collecting it from a beer. You know, like the beer we make at White Labs, that yeast is that yeast for the brewery. But when we make yeast, most of the yeast we and most of the wort we make here is for yeast. It's grown in a special way with the right, well, we use an all malt wort for most of it. Well, all of it, you know, all malt wort, unless you're talking about some really specialty wild yeast strains. And all grain for the most part. So we can give the yeast a lot of nutrition, but then also a lot of extra phosphates and zinc. So zinc and oxygen are the main things. And that'll be the same thing in brewing to maintain really high viability at the end of a propagation.
Okay.
But that means nothing if it's packaged in a way that then uses that oxygen or introduces more oxygen, I mean, which we'll probably explain here.
Okay. Is there any way to estimate the viability for a given package of yeast? Let's say I buy one of your packages off the shelf.
So you could always estimate, and I'll talk about that a little bit, but just remember, it's an estimate.
Yeah.
Right? The way to really measure your viability is in a microscope with methylene blue, no matter what. It's still got some air to it, but because you're looking at a tiny sample, it's some cells don't stain right, things like that. But it is the way to look at your yeast viability. Everything else is an estimate.
Right.
And, you know, there's on most of the yeast calculators like yours and Mr. Malty and things like that, there is a viability calculation part in these calculators,
right.
Mostly for making starters. The starters have been with the homebrewing industry since before yeast producers. And so homebrewers were always growing up yeast cultures. And so those viability estimators are handy. But I know Jamil's, for example, because Mr. Malty's, because I worked with him on the yeast book, you know, he did experiments and others have done that to create his viability calculator.
Yeah.
But it wasn't White Labs yeast and certainly not our yeast of today, but not even our yeast from before. So everybody that produces yeast, whether you're doing it at home or a different company, is going to make it up to a different physiology.
Yeah. I think all the calculators use a, you know, some kind of estimate that a certain portion of the yeast dies off every month. But when I actually got some of the viability data from your lab, it wasn't quite that simple, you know?
Right. We have our own viability calculator that we've never put out there, but we probably should at some point if people want it. But it's based on the last 10 years of data in all 80 different strains. And I've got one that's just averages it all. And I've got it by strain, you know. But and because we're doing viability numbers every day from pulled lots, from
right.
Samples that are sent back to us from shipping between our three locations. And it's I always check against that calculator. That's the averages of all. And it's really, really close to the samples we receive.
Yeah. I'd love to see it. Certainly.
Yeah. And it's quite a bit different. Like if you plug in White Labs, made on a certain date, maybe it's 4 weeks, it might tell you it's 40% dead or something. And that's just it. It'll give you a recommendation to make a large starter, so it's always going to work good. So it doesn't mean the calculators aren't working. It's cool.
Yeah.
But it's just we have a lot more viable yeast in the package.
No, I agree. The only other thing I want to ask you about viability is when is a packet of yeast really past its prime? I think you guys quote like a 6 month shelf life or something like that, right?
Correct. 7 months now with Beer Pitcher's Next Generation. So you could use it up to those dates, and not many people do. You know, most people are using it within a few months, but it does give ability to, you know, for stores to keep them or for people to keep them for long periods of time. I mean, even with earlier generation White Labs yeast, years ago, we would get stories all the time from people who had them for a year or longer and then used them even without a starter, and they work. And people would be surprised. Well, you still have a lot of viable yeast, right? So even after, and so that's where the starter comes in nice. If somebody's going to make a starter, so you could take really old yeast, and you still millions of cells per mil,
right.
at that point. So, you know, you can make a starter and recover any white Lab's yeast from the last few years. But most people want to buy yeast with as fresh as possible and use within, you know, the first few months. But we've just kept working on producing higher viable yeast this whole 28 years, really.
Right.
To get to where we are today.
Yeah. And then I think we discussed this before in a previous show, but your pure pitch stuff came right out of the pharmaceutical industry, right? The packaging.
Right. The thing we did differently was collect yeast in a concentrated form by using the film and heat sealing to a certain concentration, which is what our target is, 2.15 billion cells per mil, which is a pretty thick slurry across all of the strains. Normally, if you just collect yeast from your fermenter without some really active ways of getting it more concentrated, you're going to collect about a billion cells per mil. And that's what some other producers are at, too, of yeast producers, because that's pretty standard, 1 billion, but we can get it into 2.15 billion.
So twice as much, yeah.
Get a smaller volume.
Wow. Well, many commercial brewers and a lot of homebrewers also like to reuse their yeast. What's the basic process for harvesting yeast, you know, on the homebrew scale? I know you guys use a fairly involved process, obviously, commercially, but.
Yeah, it's funny when you talk about it, if somebody's never done it, I'll be 10 words in it. It could sound really complex, but it's actually pretty easy. And a lot of your audience, of course, is repitched yeast. You know, you want to collect it from the fermenter, the bottom. Back in the days, older days, people used to collect it from the top, but we don't have too many open fermenters anymore, even though that's the best yeast because it's up on top within the first 2 to 3 days. And so you're not waiting to the end. However, most people aren't doing that anymore. So you're collecting it from the bottom after the fermentation. So you want to remove the beer. There's a lot of fermenters now with a little valve at the bottom to collect the yeast, or a bulb that the yeast goes into. Excuse me. So a lot of creative ways of collecting yeast today. That has been for 150 years. People have been working on ways to collect yeast, you know, from the top and now from the bottom. And so you want to, ideally, again, you have the microscope, you look at what the cell count is of the slur of the, you know, homogenized slurry once you collect it. But you're going to remove the yeast from your beer anyway. You know, if you think about it, you don't just drink your yeasty beer, you even hazy beers, you know, you take off the yeast. Might as well reuse it.
Yeah.
It's what brewers have done forever, and it's healthy. It's, for the, you know, unless you're waiting a month or two, it's ready to go. You know, the yeast that has been selected by brewers is the ones that would repitch good. Excuse me. So it's really good to reuse it. And you know, contamination things, like if you're getting your slurry contaminated, you're getting your beer contaminated. If you're making good clean beer, you know, collecting slurry and reusing it is pretty straightforward.
So basically, I'd want to clean out my, you know, have a sterile vessel or a sanitized vessel to put it in. And then I should be able to just draw it off right off the fermenter, right?
Right. So back in the days with the carboys, still there are some people using them. You know, you just rack off the beer, stir the yeast into solution. And the more you do it, the better you get. You know, you're trying to get that creamy layer. And pour it into a sterile container or sanitized container, cap it up, put it in the fridge. You want to capture the yeast pretty much as soon as the beer is done fermenting. There's a big difference in what you're going to collect if you let it sit there for 2 weeks. The yeast is dying, right? So,
right.
Or versus the day after the beer is done. So that's why homebrewers back, you know, for a long time always would rack the beer to something else, take the slurry and collect it. Now, if you're in a conical fermenter or something, you can kind of just collect the yeast off the bottom. That's fine. You don't necessarily have to rack it, but there's still some benefit for clarity and things to racking a beer. But, you know, a lot of commercial breweries don't do that. They're just in a cylindrical conical fermenter and they collect the yeast and it sits there a little bit longer and then they go over to a conditioning tank and then kegging.
What's the term? I've heard about the term washing the yeast. What does washing yeast refer to?
So washing the yeast is kind of another old practice that I really don't feel is necessary anymore.
Uh-huh.
But we write about it. People still do it. And it's fine. You wash it in sterile, if you can, water. Water that you could buy, you know, from the supermarket is excellent water. There's some of the highest FDA standards for drinking water. So you don't even have to sterilize it your own or anything. So you can use that water, and you let the yeast settle out. You pour off the top of it. You pour some water on. You mix it up. You let it settle again. You do that two or three times, and you've washed out some of the true. You've removed the alcohol. But the downside is you've also removed some of the nutrients, and you gave it a possible exposure of this handling and pouring that could just give you another problem. And mm-hmm. you're introducing oxygen, which is going to degrade its shelf life.
So each time you're maintaining the sediment, or are you maintaining the pour off, I guess?
The sediment. Yeah
that's what I thought.
You're getting the yeast cream. The nice thing about commercial breweries is they when they're collecting it, as homebrewers can do, but it's a little bit smaller story, you're collecting it and you pour off the first part, or you just let it drain, right? It's a little darker. Then you get to the creamy yeast, that real center layer, and you collect that and then put it to drain again. So in homebrewing, it's a little harder to do that. You know, we're only collecting a little bit of yeast. And so I'm sure there's some people out there who are also trying to get that magical, center layer of yeast. But that's your highest viable yeast.
Mm-hmm. And then you've collected it. How do you store it properly?
Well, you want to store it in home brewing. It's pretty easy to store in your refrigerator. Commercial brewing sometimes gets a little tricky. Obviously, if they have a walk-in, easy. Put it in the walk-in. A lot of breweries, believe it or not, don't have walk-ins, especially outside of the United States. So they have to build some kind of refrigerator systems, which they usually have for other things like hops and stuff. But a lot of beer around the world, surprising to a lot of American brewers, is not stored cold. And cold rooms are very expensive. Electricity is very expensive in other parts of the world. But for yeast, you want to store it cold. You're trying to trick the yeast into this dormant phase, right?
Right.
So you've done a healthy fermentation. Hopefully you've supplemented your fermentation with zinc, and that's really going to help so many things in beer, but including yeast viability. And then you collect the yeast quickly after fermentation, after reaching terminal gravity, really ideally within one day of terminal gravity. And then you put it in your refrigerator, and you might want to burp it the first day or two if there's CO2 in there. CO2 trapped in the yeast will degrade the viability as well because it's toxic to yeast. So you want to also minimize oxygen pickup.
Mm-hmm.
That's key, right? Because at the end of fermentation, yeast store, when there's just a little bit of maltose left, the yeast knows to not eat it all. It's been programmed to store it.
Right.
We store that extra sugar as fat, and glycogen, but they only store it as glycogen, which is just all these glucoses put together. But if you collect the yeast and you introduce any oxygen in there, the yeast is going to use that oxygen. Hey, break down that glycogen you just built up in the yeast by the end of fermentation. So it's really the more you can keep oxygen out of your yeast collection, the higher the viability is going to stay. And so when I said pour it, ideally you transfer it. And that's why even collecting from the bottom is better. Collecting it through a little peristaltic pump can work. Any kind of aseptic transfer or that you can build into your system rather than pouring yeast, which is going to introduce oxygen. It's what most people do. If you use the yeast right away, I'm just saying that the more oxygen you keep out, the higher the viability is going to stay. And those are the two of the things we really focus on at White Labs: oxygen and CO2 buildup.
Right, right. Is there any trick to do that inside the fridge? Because obviously the temperature is going to drop as you go. And should I use a airlock on the top of my bottle or something?
Airlock's good, but you still might have to stir it up to get that CO2 out, a little bit. You're not trying to introduce oxygen. You're not opening the top at that point. But, the gas has got to kind of stay in solution. And homebrew in particular, compared to commercial breweries, those little fermenters and little openings tend to have a lot of saturated CO2 in there. If you ever kind of stirred up your fermenter and all this gas comes out, it's not supposed to really be like that. It's just the dynamics in our little fermenters and our temperatures we're fermenting at, and sometimes keeps it too much CO2 in solution. Hmm.
And how long can it last if I store it properly in the fridge? How long can I use it and repitch it safely?
So we'd like to say, you know, check the viability in a microscope, but reality is you're really not going to have many problems under 2 weeks. You want to reuse that yeast within 2 weeks, it's pretty foolproof. You want to use it 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, tons of people do. The viability is a little lower, but there's still a lot of yeast there. So, you know, you might not be ready to brew again in a couple of weeks. You might not want to use that particular yeast strain again in a couple of weeks. So there are people out there that are holding on to their yeast for 6 months, 8 months, 10 months, and then doing a little starter and kind of trying to get the cells to reproduce again. But in a starter, usually it's still just not really reproduction. It's just a little bit of metabolism creating some CO2.
Would the cell count in a harvested yeast sample be similar to buying a packet of yeast or not?
Well, a little bit. Like I said, most of the slurries just kind of done manually get you about a billion cells per mil. If you're collecting too much liquid, you know, it might be less than that. But it's really hard to collect it much more concentrated than that unless you have some ways like we're doing, and the film really helps us, and not many people are using that. So, you know, about a billion cells per mil will be about, you know, will be over 2 billion cells per mil. I hear people say like something like, oh, sometimes, oh, I've got 10 billion per mil. That's actually dry, so material. So
that'd be dry yeast, I guess. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, interesting. Well, how much harvested yeast is needed for a 5-gallon, 19-liter homebrew batch? Not much, I guess, right?
Not much. I mean, you know, for...
I mean, I guess if you're talking, you were saying like a billion cells per milliliter, so I guess we need, let's say it's 150 billion cells for a typical homebrew, maybe. So you're talking about 150 milliliters of yeast, not much, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, under 200 milliliters, basically, if you look at our volume, it's 70 mils at 2 billion. You could use 150 mils at 1 billion and have this kind of pitch rate we're trying to shoot for, 7.5 million cells per mil. Right. You could use 200 mils, which is probably what a lot of people do, and use a little extra. You have all that yeast you're recycling. You don't want to use too much. It's important to have a good lag phase, because yeast are taking in the nutrients from the wort. All the cells are getting the right amount of nutrients, and then they're going to start fermentation. You don't want that fermentation to start too quickly. They have because of competition with too many cells, and then each cell gets less nutrients. So you don't want to just chuck the whole thing in, you know, for you just used.
Some I don't want to take the liter of Trub at the bottom of the fermenter and dump it in there, huh?
Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't take a lot, and it actually takes more patience on the brewer side to not to be too heavy-handed. This will happen in some commercial breweries where it's so easy to use a whole bunch too, and you're making a Hefeweizen or something, and then, hey, there's no banana esters left anymore here. It's because you've over-pitched, and then they're not growing to making the right amount of growth rate to make the right amount of esters.
Right.
Or it also gets some old yeast that tastes yeast autolysis flavors. You want to, you know, get that culture to generate more cells. And I know that the homebrew industry, we got pretty good at talking about 150 billion or 100 billion or 200 billion and things like that. But it's also real easy just to talk about millions of cells per mil. And that's what the whole world talks about with yeast, right? In our little home brewing community, even commercial brewing, it's millions of cells per mil. And so that's what we're trying to put on the package, just because now you can translate that into anything. You're doing 50 liters, you're doing, you know, 30 gallons, you're doing all these different sizes. versus just a number that only applies to 5 gallons. So nothing wrong with it. It's just real specialized in the homebrewing community to just talk about a number of cells.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what are some of the other considerations when repitching your harvested yeast?
Well, you want to have good aseptic practices, of course, you know, and again, when you're home brewing, you're learning aseptic techniques. Otherwise, you have strange tasting beer. Yeah. So that helps people learn some of the microbiology clean techniques. It's more than cleaning. It's microbiology clean that you want to do. And the best brewers are great at that. Little things like dating, putting a label on the yeast collection, because you might think you remember when it was, but, you know, put the day, the month, the day, the year. Don't forget the year. Put the time, put the yeast strain, put the beer it came from. And it just becomes a habit. I know it sounds like a little thing, but I know a lot of people aren't doing that. And it can, you know, now you put the second yeast in there and, oh, it has a different color jar or something like that. I think just labeling is very effective.
Yeah, yeah, I would think so. Now, can I extend my useful life by creating a starter again from my harvested yeast? You mentioned trying to use the harvested yeast in just a couple of weeks. Can I perhaps bake it a little bit longer?
Yeah, I mean, you can pour off that liquid and you can add hopefully aseptically, through some tubing or something, some fresh wort, and let that ferment. You got to give it some time. I mean, I don't like the 1 day. I like 2 days for yeast to properly consume those carbohydrates and try to get them to make some new cells. And you'll see CO2, but remember, that's just a byproduct of the alcohol production. It doesn't mean anything more than that. It doesn't mean a whole bunch of new cells are coming or anything. It just means they're breaking it down. They're breaking that carbohydrate down to alcohol and CO2.
So you say a two-day pitch is better for a starter than a 1 day, right?
Right, because then they're also getting into consuming all those carbohydrates. They're starting to create that glycogen, which is helpful for their viability going into the fermenter.
Makes sense, yeah. Well, how many times can I reuse my yeast at the homebrew level, for example?
Well, commercial breweries tend to reuse their yeast 5 to 10 times.
Better sanitation processes.
But typically 2 or 3 times is enough for most homebrewers because you want to use a different yeast strain and it's already been 2 months to produce those. You're not brewing beer every day.
Yeah,
you're brewing in a kitchen or a garage or something and not really a good aseptic brewery, although a lot of breweries are pretty tough conditions too. You could go 99 times, 199 times. You know, it's kind of all about those skills of collection, reuse, keeping the viability high. But typically, like I say, commercially 5 to 10, they've got all their money out of it, you know.
I'm sure you know there's some old time commercial brewers that reuse it infinite times, right? Basically,
absolutely,
yeah,
absolutely, and everybody can do that.
But it's probably not the same yeast 5 years down the road, right? At that point,
right? You know, it's like seeing your child grow up or something, and it's like, oh, they haven't changed. Well, you haven't seen the change happen in front of you, right? And you could say that about a lot of different things. And it's the same way with the yeast culture. It's like, I've used it for 10 years and it hasn't changed. It probably has.
It probably has. But so yeah. Have you. Probably
so
has.
Have your
yeah.
Customers.
Well, any other thoughts on reusing yeast, at least at the homebrew level? And actually, can you talk a little bit about how it might be different at the commercial level?
On reusing the yeast?
Yeah.
It might be some similarities there are a lot of brewers and home brewers who don't want anything to do with collecting yeast. I mean, they didn't get into brewing to do microbiology.
Right.
And, you know, home brewing allows you you know, you're not spending hundreds of dollars on the yeast culture and stuff. So, you know, you can do that if you want to. And a lot of people don't reuse it. And on the commercial level, it's a little harder because now you're in the hundreds of dollars or thousands, and you really want to get some more uses out of that. So by reusing it, you actually get very low yeast costs. So some people who just don't want to, you know, reuse yeast, buy dry yeast. I think there's lots of reasons to use dry yeast. Like I said, we've released California yeast in dry form, but just to not reuse yeast is not, I think, one of them, because now your yeast costs are actually much higher because you're doing buying it for every batch. And if you reuse yeast, you can get it down, you know, to dollars or cents per batch versus still the $50 or $100 it costs to buy the dry yeast every time. So, or you can at least get it matching. And so I think there's different reasons to do it or not want to do it. But a lot of people also, maybe your listeners, sorry, today is a little low.
Yeah, you're a little
coughing. A little
dry out there in Miramar.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what happens, say in your home brewing or say commercial brewing, you start brewing and nobody really ever shows you or you don't do it. And then it just gets harder and harder to do it. It sounds so complicated. Because I get a lot of questions from people like, gosh, how should I reuse yeast? It sounds really complicated. And I always thought that was a little odd before because I thought, gosh, it's kind of easy. You're brewing beer, you're transferring liquids. I mean, it's, you know, you don't need a lab to do it. You might need a lab to make yeast,
right?
From small numbers of cells, but collecting large volumes of cells is pretty easy. It's what you do in brewing every day.
Yeah, I think you're talking about pulling like 150 milliliters out of potentially several liters of stuff at the bottom of the fermenter, right?
Yeah, beautiful yeast.
Yeah,
they've just budded in a, you know, non-oxygenated alcohol environment. They've really adapted well. People really that do it often love the third generation. If the third generation isn't going good, it's probably because the yeast it's been harvested too late or it's been overpitched, things like that. Like that's third generation is kind of your sign for you're doing it good or you're not really doing it best. It may look the same, but small details can be different. Your third generation should be your best generation. That means you're collecting the yeast at the right time after fermentation. You're not storing it too long. You're really keeping the gas out of solution. And then the next generations are working great. If by third generation is not working, it does mean you kind of beat that viability up the first time, the second time, the third time. And that's one thing that liquid yeast does really well is it repitches really well because it's grown in smaller batches. It has it just hasn't had the cell wall manipulated. It has a high viability. Ours, we have a good zinc level. And, you know, we're not introducing oxygen because there's no packaging line and we're not collecting it from a fermenter and we're releasing the CO2 out of the film. So all those things that I said that you want to do with your yeast cultures, we've tried to integrate into our production and packaging so we can deliver yeast like that in the highest viability. And little things like that you can do on your own, minimizing oxygen, maximizing, you know, having the right zinc concentration. That's why I really like the cold zinc additions with the yeast.
Yeah, I'm kind of interested. So, I mean, we've talked before about oxygen and how important it is,
yeah.
Especially in the early phases of fermentation, but we haven't really talked about zinc before. Can you just say a few words about why zinc's important and how you can possibly add it and when's the appropriate time to add it?
Well, I became really interested in zinc, 30 or so years ago, homebrewing, and in going to breweries and starting to build my yeast collection, it was the old timers that would talk about zinc. So this is not some new thing. It's just, it was like sprinkle this magic dust and fermentations go better. and so we worked with Lalama to make Cervomyces a long time, you know, I think it was 2001 or something, which was zinc encapsulated in yeast. So you could build this huge zinc population within yeast and add it to the boil. Hmm. And what that did was protect the zinc. Because right now, if you add mineral zinc, zinc heptahydrate or something like that, if you add it to your whirlpool, if you add it to your boil, goodbye zinc.
Really?
It sticks to protein. Right?
So the protein from the wort just eats it up. Huh?
It's in the troop.
So you must have to. So you must have to do a post fermentation, I guess. Then.
No, you need it in contact with the yeast. It has to go inside the yeast cell to do its chemistry.
Okay.
So, and that's the tricky part. So you can use Servomyces. We still sell it today, and that'll protect the zinc. And that gives you the right zinc concentration. Or if you want to use mineral zinc, because it is a lot less expensive and stuff, just make a sterile solution of it, you know, in water, maybe if you've got a little pressure cooker, and then add a little bit of that with the yeast into the ferment when you're going into fermentation.
What form of zinc do you use then? Go ahead, I'm sorry. What form of zinc would you add?
Most people are using a zinc heptahydrate.
Zinc heptahydrate, okay.
Just a bunch of zincs.
Yeah.
Stuck together. So why I'm bringing it up right now is people are still talking about it because it isn't new, but we get away from it sometimes. And Vinny Salerzo, you know, from Rush River Brewery, he just gave a talk to the California Craft Brewers Association at Sacramento a few weeks ago. Great talk. Him and Tom Nielsen, they gave a great talk on hops. And guess what? They're really good with hops. So dry hopping. And it was really about hop creep.
Yeah, hop creep's a real problem for the IPAs these days.
Absolutely. So they were doing Pliny the Elder as a 28-day beer just to make sure they had ample fermentation time after dry hopping so the hop creep, which is a real thing, happened in the fermenter and not the bottle the can. They've got that down to 16 days by a couple of things. One of those things was yeast health, improving their yeast health. And how do you improve your yeast health? Give it the zinc on the cold side.
I'll be darned.
Right? So we're still talking about, we're still discovering it, like in little things.
Rediscovering it.
Rediscovering it. And it also gives you a higher viability over time. It's not affecting flavor. So, you know, Dr. Michael Lewis taught at UC Davis forever. I was talking about this in the early 2000s, like why adding Servomyces is having this positive effect on fermentations. You know, I've probably maybe said this on the show before, but and he said, but it's a mystery. Like we should have enough zinc in the wort from the malt. So why is this happening? Well, it was really hard to measure zinc back then. Now we know we can measure zinc and it's zero, even if you add mineral zinc in the kettle or the whirlpool, because it just goes in the troop. So that's what this thing was. If you were adding it, it was just disappearing.
That's really cool. Well, very interesting. I did have one more question, Chris. I just you had mentioned you started doing dry yeast. How is dry yeast actually made? Kind of an interesting question.
It is made differently. Same strain. That's important, but it's not small batch processes and stuff like that. So it's a larger batch, and it's collected like we collect our liquid yeast, but then you take it and you dry it on fluid bed dryers, because fluid bed dryers really need you have to have a low temperature with yeast. You can't just lyophilizer. You can't just do things you can do with bacteria. Yeast cells are very sensitive, so they require a very gentle drying. So we looked at different facilities to do it at, and we're making it in Austria at a Lallemand plant that is really, really good in between strains because it makes pharmaceuticals there, and it's an old brewery. So, you know, I think I went and made it, and we went back and packaged it, and I think, you know, there's lots of dryers out there that they're kind of hard to switch between strains. And for us, it's super important as we're going to release more strains. We have WP 066 coming out soon.
Right.
Our London Fog Yeast. And, you know, it's really, really important to not have another strain in the package. And, you know, the level of QC we did was really extensive. So we think we made a really good batch of WP001 California Ale Yeast.
So you say dryer. I assume it's not freeze dried or anything. It's probably just air dried, right? So somehow.
Yeah, you can't freeze dry yeast, right? So air. Yeah.
Interesting. So.
I've been looking forward to really having both forms of yeast because you know, and starting with our best strain, California Ale Yeast, because now you know brewers can decide what they want. I think liquid yeast gives you the best flavored beer. The yeast has never been altered. It imports and exports all the components correctly. It can be reused the most number of times. But dry yeast has such a convenience, you know, factor that if convenience is more important to you, because getting it to you, shipping, all that kind of stuff, locations, holding on to more packages. So there's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I keep a couple packets in the fridge just in case. But you know, you never know when you might need some. But yeah, you can keep it for years. That's the other advantage, you know. Yeah. Well, Chris, I want to get your closing thoughts on yeast viability, yeast health, and of course, reusing yeast.
Yeast health. It's a lot of fun. Those are your buddies. They're making your beer. There is no happier place for a yeast to be than in a beer, right? They don't care about the alcohol like we do. It's part of the beer profile, right? But that's why it goes outside the cell. But brewers, our forefathers, you know, the brewers way before us gave us these great yeast cultures by understanding yeast health, even when they didn't know about yeast. But everything they did to create a better crop is resulted in the yeast we have today. So to honor that tradition, I think it's important to repitch. It's part of our heritage, part of our skill set, just like cleaning. Some people had to learn a new way of cleaning or get out of beer making, yeah. Just buy it. And I think this is just one of those things. And you know, and having a thought process towards the health of the yeast you're collecting, so it's not just a mechanical thing. It's not an engineering problem to solve. It's a biological thing, just like taking care of your pets or your significant others, whatever it is, like there is things you do that make the yeast feel better and live longer. And I hope we covered a few of those today. I mean, we could talk hours and hours and days to cover everything.
Well, Chris, appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
My guest today was Dr. Chris White, president of White Labs and author of the book Yeast from the Brewers Association. Thank you again, Chris.
Thanks.
A big thank you to Chris White for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. Beersmith is the world's most popular brewing software to support your beer brewing with advanced features used by craft breweries worldwide. Available in both desktop and web-based format, you can build recipes from your computer, tablet, or phone. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com or give Beersmith Web a try by setting up a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. I'd like to thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.